Baby, it's not mine. I chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, in no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass smack dab in the middle of it. Grass smack dab in the middle. We are grass smack dab.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. Well, we've got really a fine guest with us. He was my discovery. we'll tell you about that a little bit later. But his name is Eric Toll, and he's written a really fine book. He's the author of Uprising of the Human Spirit, and he talks about the consciousness being a means by which to enlighten us and bring us to a new understanding and maybe a new revolt to what is good in this world. Welcome to our program, Eric Toll.
Hi, George. It's good to be here.
Well, I tell you what, I maybe mischaracterized it. I couldn't, you know, you wrote a whole book about it, right? And I just said a few words and maybe
sure.
Maybe my conception is a little bit wrong and so forth. But tell our listening audience a little bit about your background and then, how you came to write this book and just a little bit about this book and then we'll start discussing it. It's really a fine book and very interesting.
Well, thanks. I grew up in a family where there was a certain public service, and I always thought that I would grow up to do something to always had the idea of helping people and sort of helping to improve our society. When I was young, a lot of the people in my family had been in the military, and I really thought that was the way to go about it. I ended up in the Army for a couple of years when I was a young man and really found out that really wasn't the path that was going to do the most good for things. So I got out of the military I was 25 at that point, and basically just decided I really couldn't go on trying to, carry on my life until I figured out what I was really doing. So I spent several years just reading books and trying to figure out why people are attracted to warfare and violence and why the world has certain problems that don't seem to go away. And so I really began to read all kinds of history and social science and literature, anything that could give me a hint as to what was going on. And at a certain point, I realized that I was interested in psychology and started studying psychology and went on to become a psychotherapist. I basically, having an interest in warfare and violence and that sort of thing, I started working with violent offenders, gang members, that kind of thing. I had a lot of, this was in the early 90s, I had a lot of Vietnam veterans as clients. And I basically, in looking at the work that I was doing with people, the system basically says that people's problems stem from themselves, that the official sort of American, institutional psychiatry tells everyone that if you've got a problem mentally, it's just all about you. You have a weak mind or you have a broken brain or something like this. But what I discovered in my own work, working with all kinds of people in different situations, was that what I could find with people was mostly the problems they had stemmed from the way our society was put together, stemmed from the poverty that people had lived in, and stemmed from the wars they had been in, and came from the violence that they had been exposed to, the child abuse and other problems that seemed to be generated by poverty and joblessness and various problems like this. So it began to be more and more clear to me that the real thing that was generating dysfunction in our life was the way our society was put together. So after having studied psychology for a while, I decided to, and working in the field, I went back to, and got a PhD a few years ago and really studied how consciousness evolves and how it produces new civilizations through this evolving complexity of the mind, and how those civilizations are really run. For a time, civilizations tend to be run in a very productive way. You know, all societies in the history of the world seem to have a certain golden age, they call it, where everything's running well and there's a lot of art and engineering and new science, new culture, new, you know, breakthroughs and things. And what happens over time, it seems that societies always start to go down. And so it became interesting to me in looking at those, that kind of history, how that applied to our current civilization. Why is our society declining, you know, and what happens there? And so it was in really researching the evolution of consciousness and this rise and fall of civilizations that led me to write the book, The Uprising of the Human Spirit.
Right. When you say consciousness, how do you define it in relationship in the context of this book? How would you describe it?
Well, consciousness basically, yeah, it's really just a fancy word for how your mind operates, your self-awareness, you know. We speak of human beings and higher animals of some kinds, you know, primates and maybe dolphins and whales, having a certain amount of self-awareness. They're awake to a certain degree. You know, we look at most animals and they just, you know, their lives are lived out through instinctual patterns. They don't have the ability to make different decisions. When you're conscious, you can make, you know, larger decisions for yourself. So when I say consciousness, what I'm saying is that it's really the sort of way your mind operates in terms of your ability to think about things and really make, you know, a variety of decisions.
Okay, so that gives rise to, what's that?
Go ahead.
Yeah, you were down a little bit there. So that gives rise to different types of cultures and civilizations and sort of the rise and fall of civilizations, the way people think and how much aware they are and so forth. Is that sort of what you're saying?
Yeah, that's right. Well, what happens over time is that most people are aware that physical life on Earth has evolved over time. You know, we start out with of cultures, new types of society. It has, for instance, an effect on political systems. You know, the most primitive political systems are basically just tribal societies with a kind of clan leader. You know, the old man, the old lady who's been around the longest is the leader, and, you know, they know more, so they control things. This is the sort of basic kind of political system. And as societies become more sophisticated, their political systems become more sophisticated. And we end up you know, reaching Athenian democracy that wasn't really the kind of democracy we have, because their democracy was just for the elite, just for the rich people, and everybody else were slaves, basically. But it was the beginning of something that was an opening of the mind to a new way of doing things. And then we had the Roman Republic, and then went through the Dark Ages, which was an attempt to really repress consciousness, but we can talk about that later. But, you know, we end up with, you know, the American Revolution and the French Revolution, and these kinds of openings represent an evolving consciousness that's producing a greater and greater opportunity for individual freedom. Because what evolution does for human beings in their minds is essentially increases their independence of mind. It creates more and more consciousness in the individual, which means they start to consider a broader range of opportunities. They have more creativity. They have more desire to have a greater range of decision-making power over their own life. So that leads to basically a decentralizing of political structures. You know, you start out with like kings and queens that have like all the political power, and everybody else just does what they're told, and their lives are very, very prescribed from above. You know, you're a soldier, you're a scribe, you're a farmer. But as societies grow with this growing consciousness, people become much more diverse and unique as individuals. And this basically calls on the centralized political power to give up political power. It means that power starts becoming diffuse in the masses. And this is what the founding fathers of the United States were trying to do. You know, Jefferson Washington and the rest of them, Thomas Paine, this is what they wrote about, was this idea that, you know, people can take care of themselves. People have the ability to rule themselves, and they don't need this, you know, demagogue at the top of the pyramid to tell them what to do all the time. And that by essentially allowing people to control more of their lives, you create a better society. You create a society that has more creativity, that's healthier, because the individual has more freedom to bring their own unique genius to the general scheme of things. So,
do you think that all this high tech is adding to this higher consciousness dynamic?
Well, I mean, high tech is a reflection of higher consciousness, but it's also consciousness that's moving in a certain direction.
Okay.
One of the things that's happened in our society that maybe it would be helpful if I explain basically the problem that my book highlights for the average person now.
Okay.
Is that all of our consciousness has expanded to where we desire a lot of individual freedom, and yet the political system is such that they don't really want to give up the power. Because what happens, the reason why societies start to decline at a certain point is because the various institutions, the economic system, the medical system, the school system, all the different systems, the legal system, everything that runs a society, what happens over time is they start out with new ideas and new ways of doing things that create a very healthy society. These institutions work for the people. But over time, what happens is individuals inside of those organizations begin to take over and sort of transform the organization in such a way that it starts to really cater to the needs of the elite and not so much to the people. It really becomes a money and power generating structure for those on the inside. And so what started out as something that was really there to take care of the people actually starts preying on the people after a while. So, you know, an example of this in our society is like medical insurance, you know. Medical insurance used to be super cheap. All of the, you know, if you had a job, the company would pay for it because it was something that was, you know, a few dollars a month for each person. Well, all of that got turned around because the insurance companies wanted to make more money. And they wanted to make more money for their stockholders, the top administration and this kind of thing. So what happened is now we all pay these enormous, insurance bills, even with the new Obamacare, it's still ridiculously priced. The whole thing was driven out of proportion because the insurance companies and the pharmaceutical companies started running their businesses for their own power building and money making ability instead of running them for the health of the society. So they ended up distorting the whole healthcare picture in America. You know, what happened, everybody knows, the corporations started saying, hey, we can't afford to pay for this anymore. And then this healthcare crisis came on us. And the whole thing was driven by these corporations wanting to make more and more and more and more money at the expense of the people. So we had an institutions that started out helping the people and creating a healthy society. And over time, they turn into these self-serving institutions that basically prey on the people. So when that happens, the whole society starts to veer towards collapse. So when we look at things like you brought up the technology situation, well, technology is the same thing. I mean, in many ways, technology is developed now for the benefit of the elite. It's shaped in such a way that it's there to basically increase the power of those who produce the machines. To a certain extent, things like the internet have been a big boon for people. You know, this great system for getting all kinds of information they couldn't get a hold of before, and this widespread communication. Something like that changes everything. And what the elite do is they react to that and they try and turn it to their own purposes. And so what's happened is that more and more and more of the rise in technology has been bent towards essentially increasing the power of the national security state. So that it's great to have cell phones, but now they can track everybody where they're at. It's great to have the internet, but now they can track all the, you know, half the purchases you make and all of the, what you're reading and everything else. They can read your email. It's got, you know, this other side to it that basically is used against the people.
Right. It looks like all these people are looking for monopolies, you know, of one kind or another.
Exactly.
And whether it's criminal monopolies on gambling, prostitution in a certain area, or it's political, monopolies, and they want everyone's vote, and they want to manipulate everyone's vote, but they don't want to let people be free, do they? It's a big battleground, isn't it?
Well, that's what it is. I mean, you know, it is a face-off between a philosophy that says that's very, very old. The philosophy that says an elite group of people should rule everyone else, and everyone else should serve them. And this is something that the founding fathers, basically, they knew that human beings were better than this. And so they wanted to create a country where they could thwart that tendency, they could get rid of the aristocracy, and so that people, the people themselves, you know, Jefferson basically said, if we educate everybody really well, they'll be able to defend their freedom, because through education they'll be able to know all the tricks that all the aristocracy uses to try and enslave people. So this is one of the things that has happened in the 20th century is the elite basically started figuring this out and started damaging the education system. They started dumbing everybody down so that they wouldn't be able to figure out as well what was going on. The elite it is this face-off between this elitist perspective and one that says that the people, that a healthy society is one where the people are able to share power. And it's true that, you know, by all measure, we know that this is the case, you know. That when you have a healthy middle class, a healthy basic society where average people have rights and they are respected and they have jobs, what happens is it's an amazing generator of creativity, because you have all these people out there that are always thinking of new things and they're always creating more, you know, new music, new art, new engineering, new everything. And what happens is when you start to enslave people, when you start to destroy the middle class, and you start to isolate power in the elite, is you kill that creation machine. And this is something that there are a couple of economists from, I can't remember their names, but their book came out last year called Why Nations Fail. And it was a scholar from Harvard and one from MIT. I mean, these are two of the top guys in the country. And they basically wrote this, like, 500-page book that it says exactly that, with all of these examples in world history and around the world now, that shows that when you begin to kill the middle class, when you shut down the populace, then you kill the goose that laid the golden egg. So it doesn't work anymore.
Now, would you say that many of your college graduates today seem to be on the collective left and thinking that government is the solution? Have they educated many of our university students into that kind of thinking, or what?
Well, I think what happened was that the heights of real intellectual prowess in this country in terms of universities and the general public was really in the 50s and the early 60s.
Okay.
There was a high level of intellectual ability. I mean, for instance, research that's tracked education in this country shows that I think there was a survey that came out in 2003 that showed that if you graduated in the 1950s with a high school degree, you know more than what college students graduating now know. The general knowledge of the world, that is. So what happened was that education level started going down, and that way of running colleges that used to embrace, you know, open science, open research, just research for research's sake, you know, that you could just research anything and you could develop anything, that was where the real generative organ of the country was in terms of science and even literature and art and everything we were doing. And what that led to was this bucking of the status quo. You know, after World War II, there was the creation of the national security state and the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower spoke of. And those people were really starting to centralize power and turn the United States into a huge military empire. And what happened was that the intelligentsia, the people who were really coming out of the colleges and had the sophistication of understanding the history and had that openness to do what they wanted, they began to challenge the big money powers. Well, and so you ended up with the 60s revolution and all this kind of social revolution that went on. Well, after that, what happened was the the status quo really started clamping down on colleges. They realized that that was where the opposition was forming. So they really started taking over universities across the country. And they basically shut down the open science kind of thing. There's no open science on universities anymore. Almost all of it is paid for by big corporations that then own the science that come out of those departments. Much of the university system has been bought up and influenced by major corporate interests. And so what happens is, a lot of the political thinking, a lot of the social science and everything is there to support the status quo, you know. So, yeah.
The collective left and big government is good, and let's go along with government programs, and that's the way to do. And then the big money controls the governments, it looks like to me.
Well, they pretty much are the government at this point.
Yeah, they're bigger than governments. Some of these corporations are. I've been studying the Davos meetings for years, Economic Forum, and more. Mm-hmm. Those things are big, humongous number of corporations meet there.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's one of their big sort of coordinating bodies. Yeah.
Yes, it is. It is a coordinating body. Now, have you studied any of this from the Bilderberg Group or any of these other types of organizations and their effect that they've had on? I guess they're part of the elites. I guess is the way you'd describe
sure.
it, wouldn't you?
So. Yeah, I mean, the Bilderberg and these sorts of organizations, Davos, the Trilateral Commission, yeah. these kinds of things are all coordinating bodies for what's becoming a sort of imperial force in the world that is transnational. You know, America is really the premier empire, military empire of the world, and we sort of hold the central banking power in New York,
But
we have this coalition. You know, it started out, you can read, scholars have talked about this for a long time. Carol Quigley, the great scholar of civilizations, he talked about what they call the Anglo-American Alliance, that, you know, it wasn't too long after the American Revolution that the British basically decided the best way to sort of co-opt America was to sort of align themselves with growing American power. So, you know, the British and the Americans sort of became allies in really dominating world banking and business. And,
yes, that's
and
how
what
they
that
did.
Has done
that's
is it really
did.
Brought in, sorry?
That's what exactly what they did.
Yeah,
exactly
yeah. And so
they
what they've done is they brought into that certain elites yeah. in European countries, in Japan and other places. They brought them all into a kind of, you know, a transnational elite control group, so to speak. Although I think the Americans, there's some argument about this, but I think the power still resides in America. But as a central organizing feature anyway. But so yeah, that basically, so actually, you know, what this does is, again, it is an act to try and centralize power in an elite group and everybody else be directed by that elite centralized power, whereas the evolution of consciousness is doing the opposite. It wants to decentralize power. People are getting more and more creative, more and more complex in their thinking and independent, and so they want more political power for themselves. So what happens is in the United States, a country based on, you know, philosophies of liberty and justice and democracy, they can't really, you know, come out with a kind of totalitarian country as they did in European fascism. They can't just come marching down the street with, you know, troops and guns because it would just turn into a huge war. So what they have to do in order to take over is they have to essentially convince people that they're free while they really sort of clandestinely remove those freedoms and create a society that works more on manipulation than it does on any kind of, you know, hardcore power. It's more a manipulative kind of power.
Well, how about political correctness? How does that mm-hmm. figure into this? Is that sort of on this very, it's almost fascist in tone at times where you have to think the way that we think, or you're bad and you're unwanted, and we're going to get rid of you. It almost has, you know, characteristics of that kind of fascist thinking. What do you think?
Yeah.
What would your comment
Well,
be?
I think, you know, what happened with political correctness was political correctness originally rose out of a legitimate need of people like African Americans and women and gay people and others to basically be treated with respect, you know. In American history, you know, those groups and others were not treated with respect. and they wanted to basically, so they, you know, there was the civil rights era with African Americans in the 60s, and there were, you know, the women's movement and things, and they really wanted to push towards equality. And that's a legitimate cause in a democratic country, you know. But what happens is that basic push gets turned into a set of rules that then gets applied to people in this arbitrary way that doesn't make any sense. And that's what political correctness is. It's like it turns into a thing where you can't make any criticism of somebody because they're a woman and they're the CEO. So if you say anything, well, now you hate women, you know.
Right.
And so, you know, it's like anything else. People will co-opt movements in order to basically use them for their own purposes. So political correctness, yes, George, has been turned into just a club to beat people with when they don't agree with you.
Right. You go on through your chapters here, and chapter 3 says egocentric materialism. What do you mean by that? That seems interesting as a chapter.
Yeah, well, what I'm getting at there is that there are certain ways that our society has evolved. You know, America started out as a pioneer nation with very, very basic value systems. They, you know, the whole thing that people loved about America in the beginning was that they were free from these ruling aristocrats that they lived under the thumb of in Europe. All these people moved from Europe. They didn't have to, you know, if you were a shoemaker or a farmer or whatever in Europe, then your son was going to do the same thing. There was very little way to gain any kind of independence because the elite owned everything. They owned all the land, and they basically told you what you were going to do. People came to this country, and the most beautiful thing about it was freedom. They could do what they wanted to. They were not as interested in just collecting a bunch of objects, a bunch of possessions. That was not what it was about to begin with. The idea was basically to have your own land. You know, what Jefferson said was, is if people have their own property and they can raise their own food, then nobody can tell them what to do. You know, they'll have political power if they have that. So what happened was that over time, in the late 19th century, everything changed in the United States because, you know, after the Civil War, we really started moving from an agrarian nation to an industrial nation. There was this industrialization that took place, and you had these big business guys like Rockefeller and the Vanderbilts and the DuPonts and these kinds of big names. They basically sort of won the race for co-opting or getting a hold of all the major resources in the country. So, you know, Harriman, you know, ended up with most of the railroads, and J.P. Morgan ended up with all the banks, and Rockefeller ended up with a lot of the oil and banking and all of these people. So you had this rise of what came to be known as the robber barons. And what they did was slowly turn the country into something else. Part of it was just the fact that you had this rising industrialism that then created this whole working class that lived in cities. They didn't have their own land. They were employees. They lived in cities in tenement apartment buildings. They didn't have any rights because they had no property. They couldn't quit. They were mostly the new immigrants that were coming over. And so, but what happened was that because of the advance of industrialism, you had this building of, you know, a lot of objects that people owned before the industrialism, they had to be handmade. Well, after the Civil War, with the rise of mechanics, they started making more and more machines that could mass produce products, you know, houseware items and all kinds of things. So you started to produce this massive amount of products that then could be sold to the public much cheaper than when they had to be handmade. So it produced this consumer culture in America. So what they did was they started really pushing this consumerism. So the whole idea was to transform the old pioneer culture that basically, you know, I mean, this culture was still alive. I mean, my grandparents had a farm in Nebraska, and my grandparents were like, you know, they sort of eschewed, you know, fancy stuff. They thought it was just a waste of, you know, you didn't waste money on fancy stuff, and you just bought what you needed to live, you know. You didn't buy a bunch of crazy stuff, you know. But that was exactly the old pioneer philosophy that they had to turn around if they were going to make consumerism work. And especially since you had this growing population of workers that didn't live on farms and ranches anymore. They lived in the cities and they lived in apartments. And so for them, what they sold them was basically, you can improve your life by basically just buying a bunch of stuff. That's going to be your American dream. The original American dream was having your own property and being the captain of your own destiny. You know, that was what it was about. It was about the beauty of ruling yourself instead of having some aristocrat stepping on your throat all the time. But when you were one of these new workers, the only thing you could look forward to, unless you could make your way out of the city and get some land yourself, was basically just to move up in this scale of materialism. So especially after World War II, massive amounts of people had moved out of the countryside into suburbs, and metropolitan areas grew tremendously. And the main sort of reason for people's lives in these new metropolitan growth after the war was this consumerist ideology, this buying stuff. Everybody's lives came to be dominated and sort of epitomized by how much stuff they could buy, and sort of this game of comparing yourself to others, and I've got a better car than you, so I deserve more respect, and this kind of thing. It developed a kind of what now I think is really a pathology, a kind of mental sickness of materialism. And it works with the reason it's egocentric materialism is because it basically caters to a kind of primitive understanding of the ego. You know, a person's ego is fed easily by basically going to the mall and buying fancy shoes and clothes, and if they can save up money to buy a fancy car, then they can drive around, and people will look at them and say, oh, look at that cool car, that's a cool guy, you know, that's something, or whatever, you know, big truck or whatever the person likes and others admire. This is feeding an ego in the person. It's not feeding anything that's really the higher parts of the individual's mind or nature. It's just feeding their ego. And so that's what that became really encouraged in the United States. That primitive ego competition between people was encouraged by the advertising environment and by the television shows and movies. Everything in the culture is used to basically promote this consumerism. It became a driving force of American economics. And so it produced this egocentric materialist mindset. The problem with this is that over time, people begin to realize that there's something missing, because just piling up a bunch of stuff really isn't the point to life. It doesn't feed the deeper spiritual aspects and sort of deeper needs of the human spirit. And so people begin to feel like there's something missing, but they can't quite figure out what it is. They get depressed. They think they're winning the game because they went out and got the good job. They make a good salary. They bought the stuff. They've got all the toys. They've got whatever it is they wanted, and yet they still don't feel quite right. And so this is what a lot of Americans are dealing with now. They're waking up to this idea that there's something more to us than just, you know, piling up a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, I've got a question for you. Do people ever awaken to the way they are? Can they see themselves? You know, like that old saying, know thyself. Do people ever awake to themselves?
Well, that is a subject that has really interested me for a long time, and I actually did my doctoral dissertation on that very subject. You know, what is it that wakes people up? And it's a very interesting thing, George, because it basically, there isn't just one thing that wakes people up. Sometimes it's a disaster in a person's life. You know, if they have a loved one that dies, or they lose all their money, or their house burns down, or some terrible thing happens, sometimes that shock can make people reevaluate what's really important in their life and really start to get down to what's really gonna make the future what it should be. In other people, strangely enough, it just sort of happens. It's just like development in children, where, you know, you see children grow up and their attitudes change over time, their minds become more sophisticated. Same thing happens to adults. Sometimes adults just, you know, they play a certain game for a while, and then they look around and go, you know, I think I've done this. I think I'm done with this. I need something else. I need something more. And they start to search. They start to, you know, read new books, or, you know, search out a new way of seeing things. But there's a lot of, and I think a lot of people in social science, or the cutting edge of social science now, not the institutional model, but the more cutting edge stuff, basically has been tracking this shift that's been going on, where there's a lot of signs that more and more people are waking up that our society is not what it should be, and that they themselves are sort of contributing to a larger problem just by carrying out these old ways of doing things that don't seem to make as much sense. There's a lot of people now reevaluating their lives.
I've noticed on Indiegogo, and that's a crowdfunding type of mechanism, that there's a lot of creativity or inventions going on that place, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So
yep.
That sort of reflects the ideas that you're saying about this creative thing is out there that people, they drive, they're driven to do more creative things at times.
That's right, yeah. I think we're living in a very creative period, and this is something that really threatens the status quo, because the status quo basically wants to control major markets. You know, we don't have new energy because the world is dominated by oil, and the people who have control of oil do not want anybody to develop any new energy devices. So there's a long history. You know, if you look into the details, you find that there's all these energy scientists that have died under mysterious circumstances. You know,
right.
It's because they do not want new energy to happen. They control the market. So this is something that whenever people start getting real creative and start building stuff in their garage and what have you, they have to find a way to shut that down because that threatens their power, you know. There are certain sort of avenues of product development that are open. You know, if you want to create a fancier cell phone or something, they would probably buy that. But there are some things that are closed. You know, you're not allowed to create a better, you know, a high-mileage automobile, you know. You know, the great engineer Buckminster Fuller, for instance, way back in the 30s, created a car that got like 80 miles to the gallon and carried six people, did all kinds of stuff. Well, you know, they shut that down. You can't have that. Our automobiles are basically, you know, strategically built in a way that is much inferior to what people are able to
do. Petrol driven, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's just ridiculous. I mean, and even if you're going to use gasoline, we're capable of producing cars that get three times the gas mileage that people get,
right.
You know. But so that's what happens, this creative period. So we're in this really interesting period where there is all this creativity going on, and there's all of this sort of dancing around by the status quo to capture those new creative projects or shut them down, to control people in new ways. People are becoming more and more independent, and they've got to centralize that power. So they're sending jobs overseas and you know, one of the major ways they try to control people, of course, is dumbing down the education system, which has a long history there. And this, they have a new program coming out, which the name of it slips my mind, but it's even more idiotic than the last No Child Left Behind program, which really damaged education in America. And now they're going for another round of that. So,
do you see a real time, though, effort by government and other big entities to mold and shape the consciousness of the average American?
Well, I think that's exactly the whole game that they're playing in.
That's what you've been talking about, really.
It's really, there's another chapter on my book called The Society of Manipulation. And what I do is show all the different ways. I mean, you know, the government and it's really not the, you know, to say the government, it's really kind of misleading because the exterior government that we know, those people just work for somebody else. They're not really the ones who are driving things. So it's really a sort of shadow government or, you know, these elite power centers. But, I mean, as people have become more sophisticated and they can't be sort of, you know, led around by the nose anymore, they have to think of more and more and more psychologically sophisticated ways of controlling people. So this has been something that really, I mean, it really started during the build-up to World War I. There was something called the Creel Commission that started. And it was basically, you know, Americans were like 80-something percent against entrance into World War I. They didn't give a damn whether the English were, like, getting beat up by the Germans and you know, the Europeans were beating each other up again. They've been doing it for centuries. And so the American people were like, why should we go over there and get involved in that? You know, these people have been kicking each other around forever. So the problem was is that the British had some real financial problems in building up for the war. So J.P. Morgan and some of the other big bankers lent the British huge amounts of money to build up their war machine. So they knew that if the Germans won, and the Germans were kicking them to the dirt in the beginning part of the war, they were really afraid that if the Germans won, then they wouldn't get their money back. You know, it would be a big problem for them. And plus, they had a lot of sort of allies in England. So they had to change the way people thought in America. They had to turn the consciousness around. So they started this thing called the Creel Commission, which was a propaganda operation. And the Creel Commission, George Creel was in charge of it. He hired a guy named Edward Bernays, who was, interestingly enough, Sigmund Freud's nephew.
Right.
And what Edward Bernays knew was something about Freud's psychology. Now, people talk about Freud, and he's got a lot of wild theories about things, but Freud's basic psychology is very sound. It was only when he became more sort of extravagant with his thought that he sort of went off base. But his basic ideas are that people are controlled by unconscious fears and desires. And so what Edward Bernays does is he teaches the Creel Commission how to manipulate people unconsciously through manipulating their fears and desires. So the Creel Commission became very adept at basically tricking people into changing their mind about the war. So they had speakers that went all over the country. They produced newsreels that were showing in movie theaters before the main feature. And they basically turned the country around. It was an amazing victory for the elite. They were able to take a country that was 87% something against the war and turned it into like 90% for the war. In fact, it got so bad, people got so carried away with their patriotism and their desire to go beat the Germans that there were incidents in the country where if anybody spoke up against the war, they would actually be physically attacked in the street by crowds of people. They were able to manipulate people to that degree. So that, the elite really learned a big lesson there, that psychology could be used against the American people, and they've just been, you know, on a race from there on out to basically just create a more and more and more complete sort of mind control.
So they got those World War One American soldiers go over there and fight, promised them a bonus,
yeah,
and then denied paying them the bonus.
Oh, that's classic. Yeah.
I mean, you see what I mean? And they went to Washington, D.C. and camped out lobbying for their bonus, and then they got run out of Washington, D.C. by the Army. See?
That's right.
I mean, and MacArthur was in charge of the troops that ran them out of Washington, D.C.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, and that's exactly how the soldiers are treated. They're pumped up with propaganda to begin with. They get all the young men to believe they're going to be heroes and they're fighting for democracy and freedom and all this when it's really more about some kind of economic proposal. And then they get them over there. They use them for whatever they want. And when they come back, they just dump them in the corner. You know?
Or the POWs in Vietnam, they left them behind quite a few hundred.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. See? Yeah, that's clear.
That's classic there. I mean, about
the elite,
you know.
Yeah, the elite will use people for soldiers, for factory workers, whatever. And when you have ceased to be useful to them, you will get kicked to the curb. That's the way the system works.
You'll be thrown underneath the bus, right?
Yeah, that's exactly. I mean, you look at what's going on right now. The VA is under attack for all of its terrible problems, and you know the suicide rate of soldiers and personnel in around the Middle East wars is just through the ceiling now. It's just sky high.
Is the general population though still in this sleep state with sports and entertainment and all those other things that make them feel good? You know, the ego is associated with the hero in the movie, I guess. I don't know. But can enough people awaken to make a difference in this political situation?
Yeah, well, I think that's the battle that's going on right now. People are waking up all the time, and you've got all kinds of, you've got stuff from the left to the right. You've got people like Alex Jones. On one side, you got people like Noam Chomsky and Chris Hedges and people on the left, but whatever the differences in, you know, social philosophy, they're all saying the same thing now. It's like, hey, you know, we're being taken over by big money and corporate power. And so there's a lot more. I mean, I understand Alex Jones has one of the highest, ratings of any media in the country, which, you know, I don't always agree with everything that comes across his show, but I do admire his standing up for this basic.
He's a friend of mine. I like Alex. He's great. We're both on the same station, air broadcast here in Austin, 90.1 FM.
Oh, I see. I mean, Alex Jones, I mean, that really shows the degree of the popularity of that show really demonstrates that there's a lot of people in this country who are beginning to question what's going on. So, but it's also true that, there are still a lot of people in the middle class who are asleep. They're, you know, it's like the Romans called it bread and circuses, you know, whenever the people started getting, getting antsy and causing problems, they would buy them off through welfare and more games and chariot races and gladiatorial matches. And, of course, this is what we do in the United States. We have more and more, you know, they extended all the sports seasons and more and more and more games and everything on Earth going on the television screen and big blockbuster movies coming out every week. And, you know, you just keep people distracted. And but to see the dilemma for the big money is that they're impoverishing this huge portion of the American public, because they're switching to this world economic system where, you know, they're taking all the manufacturing. Of course, you know, everybody knows this. They've been shipping all these manufacturing jobs in the heavy industry, light industry, and even a lot of the electronics and stuff, engineering overseas. And so what's happened is you have this huge section of the populace, as much as a quarter to a third, depending on whose statistics you look at, is now slipping into this underclass of you know, marginal poverty. Well, those people, you know, that's the kind of shock in a person's life that makes them start to question what's going on. So the elite are basically causing their own problems because they're waking people up by basically, you know, destroying their finances.
Right, I got you. In other words, those pocketbook issues are important. You start losing your house, it makes you think, doesn't it?
Absolutely, and you start looking around. You know, they always have an excuse for it. Of course, they're always saying, "Oh no, you know, this is because we're changing to an information society." You know, this is what they used to put out years ago. You know, we're going to be all an information
society. Yeah.
Yeah, you don't have to do those heavy, awful industrial jobs anymore. We're just going to have you sitting behind a computer, and everybody will live in a new world of processing information. Well, yeah, except that, you know, there's a hell of a lot fewer people that actually got those information jobs, and the rest of the folks are working in low-wage service jobs like McDonald's and what have you that don't pay enough to actually work. I mean to live the way Americans used to. You can't work at Walmart and buy a car and send your kid to college or, you know, buy a house or whatever. It's just, it doesn't happen. So, yeah, that shocks people.
Now what you're doing with your book is you're trying to awaken them on a lot of multi-levels, aren't you? Right?
Yeah, I'm trying to basically clue people in that there is this, that their consciousness is evolving, and, you know, it's opening up to new, there are new ways of understanding things, and there's also old ways of understanding that we need to reclaim, you know.
Okay.
Sometimes our grandparents and our great-grandparents and people before us knew better how to live in some areas than we do now, you know. We've lost some things as we've gone along, and we need to recover those things. You know, what happens is as the mind has evolved over time through history, we tend to leave behind the type of consciousness that we had in a former era. But each sort of stage of consciousness has its own virtues, you know. When people lived in a mythological kind of way of understanding things, for instance, they understood things about symbols and about images and stories, controlling stories, which is what myths are. You know, myths are basically a story you tell yourself to explain reality.
Right.
When the scientific world came around, they basically made the mistake of saying, oh, no, we don't need any myths anymore. We can just, you know, measure everything in nature, and we can write it all down, and that'll be a story that's absolutely 100% true, and everybody can follow that. Well, the problem with that is that it's not, you know, scientific theories change every couple of years, you know. It's all scientific theories are provisional, you know. They change. They used to think that Newtonian physics was completely rock solid, and then, of course, they discovered the subatomic world and quantum mechanics. But, what you know, it's an example of the mythological mind is what works in our psyche. Our psyches work on stories and on imagery. And so people in that society understood very well how the mind reacts to images and stories. Nowadays, we don't really understand that very well because we believe in this scientific realist kind of society where we think, well, oh, no, there are no stories anymore. Everything's just figured out and it's all the truth. And what this does is create an avenue through which a person can be manipulated, you know, because essentially people think that whatever they're, you know, whatever they've been taught, they just think that that's reality. You know, you ask the person, you know, the great scholar of mythology, Joseph Campbell, once said that he could tell the mythology that a person lived by just by asking them to describe reality. And whatever they said, oh, here's how the world works, that's their myth. That's the myth they live by. And when I say myth, I mean a story, a larger explanatory story. We've come to use the word myth to mean something that's not true, but it actually is true in a more symbolic way.
Right.
But if you don't understand that your mind works on these stories, on these controlling stories and myths and images, then you know, someone can use, and this is essentially how propaganda operates. It creates a new story for you to believe in, and it tries to contain you within a story that will control your life.
Compartmentalize you into a box of a way of thinking of,
right.
of reality.
A way of thinking.
Yeah.
This is what the Roman Catholic Church was all about during the Dark Ages. They tried to shut down the evolution of consciousness by basically creating a story that everyone was going to live by that said, you know nothing and you're born in sin and you're nothing but a sinner and God hates you, but if you follow us, the priests and the Pope, we will basically show you how to get to heaven, you know. I mean, if you can convince people of that story, you can really control them, because everybody wants to go to heaven, you know.
Right.
So that's
everybody wants to go there, right?
Yeah.
put your thumb out and you get there. Anyway, Brzezinski recently at a security forum, speaking with three speakers, was talking about the Russian myth that's being created, he thinks, by Putin. And what Putin is describing is a new Russian mythology, you could say, of the international Russian culture, okay?
Huh.
Yeah, and it was interesting because what he was describing, what Brzezinski was describing, is exactly what we've been discussing here.
Well, he's trying to create a new myth for his people because, the old communist idea kind of crashed, and so they've really got to come up with a new sort of central theme there.
Yeah, that's exactly what he's doing. And Brzezinski, of course, he's a big manipulator himself. He was describing the Russians manipulating. See what I mean? See?
Well, absolutely. I mean, Brzezinski, he's a Rockefeller protege.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. He's one of the big policy he's a very smart man. He has really generated a lot of the sort of imperial policy for the United States. Yeah.
The Tectonic Era and all those books he's written. And so
well,
he knows what's going on, but he's a master chess player and manipulator himself, see?
Well, yeah. I mean, the thing about Brzezinski is he came right out and said in his book, The Grand Chessboard, that America is the smartest country and we should control things and we should, you know, control the landmass of Central Asia. You know, that's what he said.
What do you think about America being like the Roman, during the Roman imperial era of Rome? Do you think America's entered in because of neocons and all that other dynamics, a period much like Rome's imperial era?
Well, yeah, I think that we're following the same old, tired imperial game plan that has been followed since, you know, maybe Mesopotamia, you know, the early Greek city-states at least, and certainly Rome was the height of that philosophy. You know, the British Empire sort of fashioned themselves off Rome and learned a lot of things from the Romans in administering a larger empire. But, yeah, that's, you know, America is basically the last of the Roman-type empires that basically seeks to control resources and create a larger sort of imperial economy and all of that. But, yeah.
And then at the end, they were giving bread to everyone, too, in Rome, right?
Well, so the Romans mismanaged
here they're giving everybody food stamps, right? See?
Well, yeah. I mean, the Romans mismanaged their empire because, again, it was the classic structure I'm talking about where the elite start to co-opt all of the institutions for themselves. They don't want to change.
Yeah.
They don't want to change anything so that they can keep the society healthy. They just want to keep the power and the money. And so they started making decisions based on that ended up just driving the empire into the dirt, essentially.
Capitalism is what that reminds me of.
Well, yeah, Rome had a high period, you know, in the first century, you know, going back, you know, from the first century BC to in the early AD. But they just, it's the same pattern. The elite basically hold on to power. They won't make changes they need to, and the whole thing gets just driven down. It becomes weakened at the center, and then, you know, the stronger societies that have grown up around the periphery, that are in an earlier stage of their growth as a civilization, they're in the healthy early stage, then they overrun the weak old empire.
Right. You know, is America going to make it out of this downturn and all of these people coming in across our borders? And I was reading someday about MS-13, that group, that gang out of El Salvador.
They are
actually letting in known members, so to speak, because they've got tattoos all over their bodies.
Yeah.
They're trying to recruit members in these detention centers, and then they're releasing them to appear at some court hearing so many months from now. They shouldn't be allowed in the country at all if they if they're subscribing to the MS-13 gang rules or you know.
Right. Yeah, that's totally. Yeah. George, you know, what the basic philosophy here is for the elite is divide and rule. You know, it's a very simple thing. You cannot, a small group of people cannot control a large group of people unless you split that larger group of people into all kinds of warring factions. So this is the game plan in America. They know they want everybody to keep looking left and right instead of up and down, because up and down is where the real discrepancy is, you know, in terms of income.
Yeah.
So what happens is they have to, as people become more aware that things are wrong and more, you know, political agitation begins, they want to find more and more ways of putting everybody at each other's throat to create more chaos in the society so that people can't politically organize against them. This is the oldest manipulation in the world.
The problem with this today is they can identify scientifically with NSA and all that more of the people that are against them than any other elite leadership has ever had before.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
that's
it's
a danger
scary.
To all our liberties and freedoms right there. We've got a couple of minutes left. Would you have any concluding remarks or statement you'd like to make, Eric Toll?
Well, sure. You know, the thing that the sort of conclusion I come to in my book mainly is that this is a time for people to really review their values as human beings, really review their lives, really take a look at, you know, what are you voting for with your dollars? You know, what are you supporting with the things you buy? You know, where does this money go to? And are these, you know, what is most valuable in your life? Is it experience or is it collecting objects? You know, how much of your ego is really engaged in this game of trying to sort of buy your way to respect, you know? What happens when people start to develop is they start to drop that game and they start to just develop themselves. They start to reach down into their own depths and they start to realize that there is a creative impulse in them that will lead them to a life that is most appropriate for them, that is their authentic identity. And that authentic identity will produce, you know, a pastime. It will produce a way of living and a way of working that will make the person the most happy. And it's something that's driven by a healthy kind of human a system that's deep in people. And it basically, when people start to pay attention to that and start to make changes in their lives that are devoted to that deep human spirit and get away from all of the things that are crashing, you know, start to look at the ways that you're being manipulated. It's not just the advertisements. It is the television shows themselves contain all kinds of manipulative themes, all kinds of, you know, what do the characters in the shows believe in, you know? That's the kind of thing that sort of silently influences people. What's going on in the movies? What values are they championing? And are they representing people in a way that's not true? You know, are they representing American power that's in a way that doesn't really match what's really going on in the world? You know, so this is really an age for people to reevaluate their lives, reevaluate what they're supporting, take a look at, you know, because this manipulative society has developed to such a strong degree, we're really swimming in a sea of manipulation. So it really takes some time to pull back. You know, I advise people to go into nature where you don't have any influences outside of just pure what's supposed to be there, you know, just pure nature. Go into a wilderness area and just start to get your head straight as to what's important, what's real for you, what is your real impulse in life in terms of how to live right.
Okay, Eric Toll, thank you very much, author of Uprising of the Human Spirit. We have click-offs on our site right now that you can, where you can go to find that book and his own site and so forth. But thank you for listening and being with us tonight to our listening audience. And thank you very much, Eric, for being with us and explaining this thing about consciousness. And it can make a difference, can it?
It absolutely can. Thanks very much for having me on, George.
Okay, Eric Toll. Thank you very much. Good night.